Welcome to the healing power of your dreams on UK Health Radio. I'm Teresa Chung, dream decoder, spiritual growth expert, and your guide to the hidden wisdom of your inner world. Each week, we explore how your nighttime dreams, daydreams, and waking intuitions hold powerful messages for healing, insight, manifesting, and personal transformation. Even just by listening each week, you'll start tuning in more deeply to your own inner voice, waking up with greater clarity, purpose, a sense of connection to the invisible strings in your life, and dreams and gratitude for them on your mind. So join me weekly, live or on demand, and just like a dream, expect the unexpected. Yet, it is in our idleness, in our dreams, that the submerged truth sometimes comes to the top. Virginia Woolf. Hello, everyone, and welcome again to the recurring weekly dream that is this show. I'm your host, Teresa, and you're listening to the Healing Power of Your Dreams on UK Health Radio, the world's number one talk health radio. To explore my dream work credentials and titles, visit teresachung.com. I've written numerous non-fiction titles on dreams and intuition. And if non-fiction isn't your vibe, my new paranormal thriller, Nightborn, is a fast-paced novel that doubles as a crash course in dream decoding. It's out now on Amazon. Readers are already reporting boosted dream recall. Now, whether you're tuning into this show live or on demand, thank you for honoring your dreams and giving your inner world the attention and respect it deserves. This matters because what you think, feel, and dream is what you tend to attract into your waking life. Like energy seeks like energy. Each episode aims to offer you deep, inside-out meaning and healing. I'm delighted to share that last week's guest, Alexandra Wilby, who's a sound healer and deputy editor of Hello Magazine, will return as promised in February with a special sound healing segment to boost your intuition by day and your dreams by night. And the king of lucid dreaming himself, Charlie Morley, will also join us in the new year alongside other visionary and returning special guests. More surprises are coming throughout the final shows of this year too, and into the next. I genuinely have goosebumps thinking about what lies ahead for you today and in the weeks to come. And remember, you can always email me at dreampowerhealing@gmail.com with your questions about your dreams and intuitions. I read every message and aim to answer them via email or on air, just like now. Charles, you recently emailed about bees showing up time and time again in your dreams, and that's wonderful news for you. Bees are highly auspicious symbols of harmony, creativity, and the sweet rewards of dedication. They often appear to reassure you when you have a setback that this is no time to give up because you're supported and you are, despite appearances, moving in the right direction. Keep on going. And several of you have also asked me about that classic teeth falling out dream, one of the top three most commonly reported dreams. It's often misunderstood as negative, but let's decode it positively. Dreams symbolize personal power, how you bite into life. When they crumble or fall out in a dream, it often reflects overgiving, not speaking up, or struggling to assert boundaries or be your authentic self. This dream isn't here to frighten you, it's here to wake you up. It's a call to reclaim your voice, protect your energy. Not surprisingly, carers often experience this teeth falling out dream, along with dreams of not finding a restroom or neglected animals and children. These kinds of dreams are always a sign that you urgently need to nourish your own needs with the same compassion you offer others. Which leads me perfectly to today's special guest, Jess Baker. She's a chartered psychologist and author of the award-winning and highly recommended title Super Helper Syndrome, a pattern when giving to others becomes so automatic we forget to receive. So if you've had that teeth falling out dream, or if you identify as someone who feels too responsible, too available, or too empathetic for your own good, this conversation is absolutely meant for you to listen to today. Through her empathy-powered coaching method and use of augmented empathy, Jess helps her clients strengthen self-trust, set clearer boundaries, and lead with calm, grounded confidence. She is a keynote speaker and media contributor on empathetic leadership, compassionate conversations, and the future of work. Hello, Jess, are you there?
I am here, and it's lovely to be here, Teresa. Thank you so much for the invitation.
It's our absolute honor. I've long admired your work, Jess, and then I got to know you, and my respect for you knows no bounds. Thank you for being here. But for listeners who've never heard this term before, can you just dive into super helper syndrome, why you coined that term, and why are sensitive, intuitive, and caring individuals especially prone to it?
Oh, thank you. I'd love to. So let's say a super helper is somebody who gives without boundaries, who enjoys giving, but actually they do so in a healthy way. So not necessarily without boundaries, but in a healthy way. But when you take that compulsion to help and you add the no needs belief, you add that aspect of they matter more and I matter less, then you're less likely to look after yourself as well. That old saying, put your oxygen mask on first. I like to think of it as a watering can, watering your plants. You can't water your plants, you can't nurture anything if the water can is empty. So super helper syndrome then is talking about when you're giving too much in a way that's detrimental to your own well-being.
Thank you for that concise explanation of it. But I guess for people who are spiritual and on their path, we're often told, aren't we, giving is living. That wonderful book, Tuesdays with Maury. I recently read it, and this wonderful message about giving is living. And I know I was always brought up to put others before myself. Many of us have. What would you say to people listening then who believe that is how they should live their lives, reaching out, caring, giving.
Yeah, that's a good question. I think we get caught up, and I include myself in this because I wrote the book. I wish I'd written it, 30 years ago and read it 30 years ago, because I was aware of my own giving habits, but it mostly became really obvious to me when I had coaching clients who would just find me on the internet and they would come again and again and again with this focus on other people, which is lovely, which is needed, which the world needs more of. We understand that. But when it comes without boundaries or weak boundaries, when it comes, as I said earlier, at the detriment of our own well-being, then that's not helping anybody. So I think there are a couple of things. Firstly, with other people, what we find is when, let me step back a second, because there are two elements of your question. You're going to have to remind me of the first, but the second one is really important because when we are empathic, oh yeah, I got it. Make a note, standards. When we are empathic and we grow up with a cultural or societal standard or religious standard of others matter and treat others as you would want yourself and give, give, give. We then forget sometimes that we matter too. And what sometimes happens, I call it the empathy dial. Okay. What sometimes happens is our empathy dial is healthy. I tune into you. I'm empathic to you. I can understand and see your suffering and your joy, by the way. Empathy is also really about pleasure, too. But what sometimes happens is that dial then tips into an unhealthy zone where now your opinion, your judgment, criticism, or even imagined criticism of me matters more than I matter to myself. So your voice, or the voice of others, becomes more important. So when this empathy dial is on high, we stop hearing our own voice, our own inner voice. We stop trusting ourselves, and suddenly we've kind of lost sense of who we are. So the two things work together, to go back to the first part of your question, which is, how do we navigate that? I think there are a number of things that encourage us to be empathic, which are social standards, cultural standards, religious, childhood messages. You know, I grew up as a parentified child, which meant that my mother heavily relied on me to be her emotional crutch. And that made me a kind of survival mechanism, made me into someone who could finally tune into and readily tune into other people's needs and anticipate them. So how about that?
I'm glad you mentioned your personal experience of this, because that was my next question. You kind of sensed that ahead of time, that you have a personal experience of this. Would you mind sharing a bit more about that?
Sure. With my upbringing, I now look back and I see it really clearly how the kind of golden thread of empathy has played out. And whilst I had a mother who had narcissistic personality disorder, met a lot of the criteria for that, so I do not say that lightly, I'm a chartered psychologist, she also used me and relied on me, as I say, as an emotional crutch. So what I didn't know this until I was in therapy in my late 20s, but it wasn't my fault. It wasn't my fault that I didn't know what I wanted to be. So as I grew up in this childhood state of not being asked what I wanted, not being asked what I needed, not being asked what my opinions were, but always just assumed that hers mattered more and that I should assume hers, I grew up in a really kind of insecure familial environment. And according to Jung, you know, I didn't have very much opportunity to individuate. And most of us don't. We spend our whole lives trying to individuate, right? And at the same time, when I was four, my mother actually introduced me to a childminder, because my mother worked full time as a single mum. And that childminder, whom I called Auntie Jean, then became, unbeknownst to us, my guardian angel. And she was the rock solid foundation and the only source of unconditional love, which I also found out about when I studied psychology in A-level. I was like, oh, that's what's missing. And that was, she was my guiding star. She was my guardian angel. And even though she departed this earth a couple of years ago, she's still with me every day. So I dedicated the book to her, which was really lovely.
Oh, beautiful. As you're speaking and I'm watching you, I can tell you must identify as highly sensitive, empathetic, intuitive. I mean, that scale of it. And I would guess from your research that people who are highly sensitive, in other words, they kind of feel the world, don't they, really? They probably identify more or end up in the super helper category. Am I correct there that that's a natural fit?
I think so. I think I've made a distinction between, and it's a very fine line between highly sensitive and empathic, because yes. I think if you, and the reading I've done, so I'd love to know what you think about this, Teresa, as you're well versed in this area much more than I am. But I think with highly sensitive people, that's a category of people who sense a lot and can be quickly overwhelmed by even, you know, too much light or too much noise or a certain fabric against the skin. And I relate to some of that. Whereas I think empathic people are usually highly sensitive. So there's like a little Venn diagram going on. They're usually highly sensitive, but it's that sense of others that they're tuning into. It's not just highly sensitive about themselves. It's not that experience of just themselves. It's the other person. It's the cognitive empathy of, I know how you feel, or I know that you're experiencing something. And then the empathic empathy of, I share that feeling with you. So that's how I would describe how those can come together.
Absolutely. And someone who's a carer, for example, I'm sure many UK health listeners are in that category. What advice would you have for them? Because they're kind of, you know, some of them stepping into it because they have no choice to be the super helper. They have to kind of take care of other people, live two lives, as it were. What advice would you give to them? I mean, they may not super helped, but maybe you're saying that some people are super helper because it's their choice, but other people, it's kind of life makes it happen. You know, maybe a partner or a loved one needs their care.
That's
What
right.
are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think how you get to becoming a super helper or at risk of super helper syndrome, you know, when you're giving and giving and giving, you're right, is absolutely either because it's in your nature and it's something you feel called to do. I mean, I wanted to be a psychologist since age 12, you know, it's been a lifelong calling for me. But you're right, you know, we can find ourselves in those situations when we have children, when we have partners, when we have people in our family who inevitably begin to decline in some way. We then take on that carer role, and it usually falls to one person in the family, doesn't it? You know,
Yes.
we know this. I use the term, you know, are you the fixer in the family? And there's always a nod, yes. And I do have siblings, but where are they when somebody needs to step in and make sure the parents are getting the medication or the treatment that they need? So I think in answer to your question, what would I suggest or recommend? It's a very, very, very long answer. Obviously, please do read my lovely book, The Super Helper Syndrome. But I think in this immediate term of listening to the radio program, there's a sense of choosing. I would draw straight to your helping boundaries, okay? And this will be tough for you. And I know it will be tough for you to do this because I've been there myself. But if you can sit with it for a while, explore it, come with it, come to it with a playful curiosity, think about these three things. Who are you helping versus who do you actually need to help? So do you have, like, there's an exercise in the book called the friendometer, you know, simply plucking those friends who aren't really friends into the helpy bucket can be really life affirming. And you think, oh, I don't actually have to help that person. It's not my responsibility. Okay, so who you help, when you help, thinking about, well, when am I helping? I used to pick up my phone to my mom like 5 or 6 times a day when nothing really was happening, but it was full of drama, or it was, you know, just me playing out the role of the good girl, the good daughter. I would pick up my phone because I can. In the end, contracting with her, saying, Mum, hey, I can't really give you much time now, but on a Sunday, I can give you a whole hour. And let's talk for a whole hour, in which case I could just plug in my headphones and sit there, you know, for an hour. And it didn't really work, but it can work with other people who you can say, I don't really have much time at the moment, or I'm really quite busy, but I'd love to give you some time at a later day. If you still need to talk about this next Wednesday, how about we have a cuppa together? So who, when, and how you help. Now, in the book, as you'll remember, my co-author, who's also my partner, Rod Vincent, we map out lots of different types of helping, lots of different forms of helping. I navigate straight to supportive help when actually there are other forms as well. So resources help, for example, and expert help. So what kind of help are you giving? What kind of help is that person asking for? And what kind of help do you find more energizing? You know, I much prefer someone to phone me up with an emotional question than ask me to borrow the screwdriver. You know, I would absolutely happy to sit there and listen for an hour while, you know, while you shared everything. So yes, who you help, when you help, and how you help, I think in succinct terms, that's as succinct as I can be at this stage.
It's a huge topic, and we've touched on so many things. You mentioned narcissism there before. I'd like to go a bit deeper into that. Actually, we should do a whole episode on that, you know, recognizing and dealing with individuals like that who can literally consume you. And people also who get their identity from the caring role, their feel good boost as well. Love to unpick that. But I'd also love to, because we're just about to go to an ad break. Unfortunately, I'd love to talk about the dreams of people that you've spoken to who you have kind of diagnosed, I hope that's the correct term, with super helper syndrome. So please don't go away, anyone. We'll be right back in a minute or so. Stay with us.
Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Apples and pears, beef and skittles, cider with Rosie, common or garden, aunt and deck, fish and chips, mum and dad,
UK Health Radio and Health Triangle magazine. Each is good by itself, but enjoying both is always better. Add Health Triangle magazine to your monthly health regime. Check it out at ukhealthradio.com. Strawberries
and cream. A cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Welcome back to The Healing Power of Your Dreams, where I'm with the wonderful Jess Baker, author of the award-winning Super Helper Syndrome. And there's so many strands here. I'm going to go first with what I previewed before the break. When you were talking about narcissists, or, you know, it's a term that's bandied about in the media a lot at the moment, a lot of people being labeled it. What's your understanding of it? And, you know, there's also... is there a kind of a psychic vampire energy about narcissists as well? Because we're talking about energies in this show. I'd love your thoughts on that.
So I think I'd stay with my own experience, actually, to keep it kind of real world rather than go into kind of research jargon and definitions, if that's okay, Teresa. As I was saying earlier, you know, for me and for many daughters of narcissistic mothers, and there's a whole... beautiful movement out there online, it's a sense that you are kind of an appendage to that mother. So you are there to serve them. You are just a kind of happy accident, maybe not even that necessarily that happy, an accident, but they are wanting to live through you. So for me, it was very much around, as I said, you know, earlier, not being asked what I wanted, what I valued, any of my opinions, what I needed. And really, I found it very difficult. Lots of children of narcissistic parents do find it very difficult to navigate those early years. And going into teenagers when you're supposed to be finding out who you are, suddenly you're faced with, I have no idea who I am. So I think intuitively, that's actually what led me to wanting to be a psychologist when I was 12, because I ended up... So how about this as a really poignant moment, one of the very earliest in my life? I had lots of stress headaches, lots, and kind of one continual stress headache from the age of about 9, 10, 11. By the time I got to 12, I'd had so many CAT scans and MRI scans. I'd been in and out of children's hospital. Thankfully, there was one locally to me in Southeast London. And I was kind of in and out of there. And eventually the clinical neuropsychologist or neurosurgeon said, here's all your MRI and CAT scans and there's nothing wrong with you. And then at this point, he did something really strange. He asked my mother to leave the room, which I don't think would be allowed at this time. But without her there, I was able to speak freely. And he said, look, what's really going on? And I simply said, give me someone to speak to and I'll be fine. At the age of 12, I knew that's all I needed. I needed somewhere safe to just download all of this stuff, all of my experiences, to try and make sense of it. And through working with this most amazing child psychiatrist, I then thought about the field of psychiatry and then the field of psychology. So I think that kind of set me on, you know, a really beautiful trajectory into where I am now. And I think that... you mentioned the energy. Yeah, it's extremely painful and aggressive energy that can sap. Yeah. Not just sap, but kind of just like land on you. You know, I could have a call and I could see my mother's name on my mobile phone, you know, and my energy is gone. Or it's a call from the hospital and I turn up at the hospital and... I'm no longer there. I'm role-playing straight into the good girl and the good daughter role again, and kind of forgetting who I am and not knowing that.
Of course, I mean, this is really interesting conversation. We could talk for hours, but I'm guessing a lot of people who identify with super helper syndrome, meaning they're very empathetic and caring and always put others ahead of themselves, they won't necessarily always be with a narcissist or someone who is draining their energy in that way. So somebody who, say, for example, is that kind of gets their sense of self from being a carer. If someone listening recognizes themselves in what you're saying, what's the very first boundary, the very first baby step they can take or set for themselves, even if it feels uncomfortable or unfamiliar?
You don't ask easy questions, do you, Teresa?
No.
Okay, so I think it's beautiful. I love your questions, so thank you. I would say that let's unpack this a little bit. So we've got, if you are susceptible to super helper syndrome, and to come back to a point you made earlier, no, I would never diagnose anyone. This is for some people to self-assess, you know, yes, I'm a super helper and I love doing these things, but I have this also, this desire not to do anything good for myself. Therefore, I've slipped into super helper syndromes, which is an emotional and behavioral state that we can find ourselves in. So I wouldn't ever use that. It's not a medical term, but it does help to have a name for something sometimes, doesn't it? So I think if you've slipped into super helper syndrome, you can do so, and you can do so because you've been exploited by somebody. Now, that doesn't have to be necessarily you're in a direct relationship with. It could be your manager at work. You know, it could be someone in your family, sure. It could be someone you've chosen to be a life partner with. And I think the empathic person is likely to be exploited, more likely to be exploited than other people, because they are so sensitive. Because do you remember what I said earlier about others mattering more than we do? We assume their identity, we assume their opinions, their judgments, and their worldview readily. And so that boundary between us and them becomes really thin. And so suddenly what they're saying matters more than what I think. What they do in the world, what they find meaningful, matters more than what I find meaningful. So it's that all-consuming kind of assimilation that we can go through, where we almost merge with that personality.
Yeah, and I guess something that you can do, maybe you don't agree, is actually recalling your dreams and listening to your intuition is a great way to start having that sense of self. Have you had clients that their dreams have literally revealed the root of their overgiving behavior?
Yes, I have.
Then they can't use it to themselves.
And I think what I try and help my clients do is tap into that self-trust again, because other people, their opinion, judgment, etc., has become so important to them. They've forgotten how to listen to themselves, that self-trust, that intuition. And so sometimes I'll be on a call with a client. I work virtually as I am here. And they'll express a dream, they'll express a pattern. And what we'll do is be able to find out, you know, what's underneath that. Is it the emotion? You know, I love that when you said earlier about the teeth falling out, I used to have that dream so frequently, and I haven't had it in decades, maybe a decade or more, which is wonderful, because I really feel like you were talking about the overgiving, and it's a sign that you need more boundaries. And I think for me, definitely I needed more boundaries in that state. So I think it can be magical when you use intuition, as I do so strongly in my own coaching practice, to enhance and amplify the empathic traits that I also bring to my coaching clients too. Yeah. I mean, you're talking about dreams. I'd love to tell you a little bit more about how the book came about, and, you know, there's a nice thread
that.
There if there's time.
Time is just disappearing. There's so much I want to dig deeper into your augmented empathy as well, and talk more about dreams. But before that, I ask special guests to choose a song that has meaning for them and that they would love UK Health Radio listeners to tune into. So would you mind, Jess, just sharing your song now and why you feel it would benefit UK Health Radio listeners to absorb?
My chosen song is Asclepion by O'Reilly and Vincent. Rod Vincent is my partner, co-author of The Superhelper Syndrome, and an award-winning poet. On a visit from Dublin a few years ago, Finn Connerty, our friend, came upon a pile of Rod's poems. Finn, being a masterful musician, put them to music, and Rod rewrote some of parts of them as lyrics. They created their first album, Clearance Sale, by accident in just 48 hours. And this song is their latest release from their second album, Utero is Breathing. It was inspired by our visit to the ruins of Asclepion on the Greek island of Kos. It was a temple of healing where people went for rest, psychological support, exercise and dream interpretation, which is why I chose it for you, Teresa. So here's Asclepion by O'Reilly and Vincent.
Monumental heat. The girl takes photographs of seven pillars resting on a hunk of ancient marble. You rub your arms and legs with factor 50. Come inside to learn the art of healing. Come inside to learn the art of healing. You're trying to ignore incessant cheering, cicadas worshipping Asclepius. In the columns of cypresses encircling the grey stone debris and the antique dust. Come inside to learn the art of healing. Come inside to learn the art. The girl stands on a vacant pedestal, makes a Greek goddess of herself. You drink orange from the man who squeezes 6 euros from each aching tourist. Come inside to learn the art of healing. Come inside to learn the art of healing.
Welcome back to Dreamland, everyone. I have so many questions for Jess and so little time, but that kind of mirrors the dream state, isn't it? Which is a perpetual question and shifting scenes. But we move into the part of the show now, which I really, really relish, because we invite wonderful people who are experts in their fields to come and join the conversation. And I'm delighted to, first of all, welcome Frida to the Nightlight.
Hi, Teresa. Hi.
Hi, Frida. Please tell us who you are. I know you are an esoteric astrologer. Yes. Fascinating work. So please share who you are, what you do, and what you'd like to ask Jess about her work with Superhelper Syndrome, intuition, empathy.
Yes, sure. My name is Frida Elahi. I'm a clinical psychologist with a PhD in developmental psychology, and I'm based in Sweden. And Even though my day work is about studying youth development, I've always had a love for the esoteric, and especially astrology, actually. Apart from my work, I have now recently written a book that's coming out next year, which is like a practical guide on how to combine the esoteric astrology with modern psychology. And in Sweden, where I'm located, it's very uncommon to sort of combine these kind of practices, the esoteric, non-scientific, with psychology that is like a science today in the modern world. This idea for my book came from this kind of conflict I've been carrying within me as a clinical psychology for over, 12 years now. So what I'm curious to ask you, Jess, as a fellow psychologist, is do you feel that there's a space for integrating like intuition or integrating the esoteric components, symbolism or non-scientific, more esoteric practices with modern psychology as it looks today? And do you think that could support people? And do you also think there could be some challenges to this? I'm really curious to hear your opinion as a seasoned psychologist. Thank you.
No, Frida, thank you. What a fantastic question. And what an amazing crossover you're having, with your experience, with your profession. I think that's really lovely. And just to say, there's a quick link because Finn, who was the musician and singer on that previous song, was actually based in Sweden right now, so in Gotham City. So there's another weird and wonderful thing that's happened. So I think yes, absolutely, hands up. There is a space for psychologists to embrace the esoteric, to understand. And I think that's where augmented empathy works for me. So I've coined the term augmented empathy, and perhaps we could have another conversation about this some other time, Frida, where I've noticed over the decades of the work that I've been doing, I have been drawing not only on empathy and not only on intuition, but I've been kind of going through that information to see more. So, for example, I use a term called through sight, which is I'm working with a client in front of me. I'm empathizing with them deeply. They're talking about somebody they're having a problem with, they're struggling with, a difficult manager or a relative that isn't, doing, is crossing boundaries, let's say. I'm able to get information about that third person. And I think this is where it can help our practice. If we can learn this, I'm not sure how. I mean, Teresa, you've written on intuition and developing that as a skill. I think there's a real opportunity here to learn more, to learn how. Yeah, psychology is a gateway. Empathy is part of that, essential part of connecting with anybody. Intuition is definitely an enhancer of that, kind of amplifies it. And I think in my work, so for example, if you'd indulge me, I might say on a coaching call, I've got a hunch, what you keep saying about this person's obviously I only hear about them through your words and micro expressions, etc. But how about this? So I'll come at it with a playful curiosity, and this hunch will land. And sometimes it will land in a really surprising and shocking way for that person. So sometimes I have to obviously gently guide them through. So, and they'll say, "Well, how did you do? How did you know that? Or that happened a year ago? Or that happened last Wednesday." So there is this other sense for us to draw on to amplify the impact, the positive impact that we can have in our work as psychologists, for sure. What a great question! Thank you,
But
Frida.
don't you think we have to maybe broaden a little bit our understanding of psychology? Because sometimes in the Western world today, it's very limited the understanding we have. And we're also facing a little bit of scientism, I would say, where the only what is approved by science is valuable. But I think we should go a little bit beyond that also and see how can we bring in these sort of practices that can enrich people's lives this way? So I really love your answer. Jess, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Frida. And your work sounds amazing. What a learned panel we have today. And I'm very grateful for your contribution, Frida. Thank you. And do keep in touch with the show. It was really interesting. And I love the synchronicity that you mentioned there, Jess. For me, there is no such thing as coincidence. And we do have to go to another quick commercial break, but please don't go away. Frida, Do hang around if you want to. It's entirely up to you. But don't go away, because on the other side, you're in for a treat. We have a parapsychologist, a dear friend of mine, and someone I also ex respect greatly, Professor Callum E. Cooper. And he's going to be taking the stage and talking to Jess. So don't go away. You don't want to miss a thing.
Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
What if your healing journey could feel empowering, hopeful, even transformative? Welcome to the Alkaline Collective Mastermind, a community for anyone facing cancer, staying cancer-free, or committed to prevention. No matter your stage, whether you've chosen conventional care, an integrative path, or a fully holistic approach. Here, you're not alone. Here, your healing journey becomes a journey of empowerment. We explore the science of oxygenation, metabolism, and alkalinity, while strengthening your emotional, spiritual, and physical well-being. This is a mastermind with heart, accountability, connection, wisdom, and real support. Because your journey isn't just about surviving, it's about thriving. Join us by clicking on the Alkaline Collective Mastermind banner on the UK Health Radio homepage or directly at alkaline-collective.com, where self-belief grows, healing deepens, and transformation begins.
When you vacation with Norwegian Cruise Line, every day is a new day. Get a taste for Barcelona, then savor incredible dining options back on board one day. Connect to ancient history in Athens and then disconnect completely in our spa another day. Wherever the sea breeze takes you, come aboard and experience a different tomorrow with NCL. Visit ncl.com, call your travel agent, or call 0333-336-1472. Norwegian Cruise Line, Ships Registry, the Bahamas and USA.
The station that makes you feel good.
Welcome back to the Healing Power of Your Dreams. And I'm just about to introduce our next guest to ask Jess a question, Professor Callum E. Cooper. And Cal, before you come on, I'd love your thoughts as well and to ask Jess about this too, both of you. Dreams where people are actually helping others in the dream state spiritually. That would be a really interesting sleep worker where, you know, you're such a caring person that you carry on in spirit being there at scenes of crisis or accidents or when someone's passing in the dream state. I'd love your thoughts about that. But Cal, over to you now. Hello.
Hello. How you doing?
I'm good, thank you, Cal. Please share who you are, what you do. And your thoughts on today's conversation?
I've missed today's conversation because I've
Great.
Literally come from, I've come from other PhD meetings and another radio show. So literally at 5:30, I don't know what's been said. So I'm Professor Cal Cooper. I'm a parapsychologist. I deal with thanatology, so death and bereavement. I deal with sexual behavior and positive psychology. But I mainly discuss day-to-day strange experiences people have had and talk about healthy skepticism. And I deal with laboratory research into this, where we used to test the select few people that would, you know, make these claims. But we also look at what's going on in the general population as well. So that's my day-to-day job. And we've got a very large research centre at the University of Northampton.
Absolutely. And Jess, she has coined the term super helper syndrome and also augmented empathy, the role of intuition. I wondered if you had any questions about that, psychologist to psychologist as well, because I know Jess is very interested in precognition, telepathy, all these things and the role in psychology. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, how would you define a super helper?
Yeah, Jess. Hey.
Welcome to the conversation, Karen.
Hello.
I'm sure there will be other listeners jumping in right now as well, so that's absolutely fine. So a super helper is somebody who is, feels compulsively or feels compelled to help others. When you get into super helper syndrome, you are realizing that you're helping others to the detriment of your own well-being. So this is not a syndrome as in the medical term, but as in the second definition, a collection of emotions and behaviors. So I've noticed with my work over the decades that so many people who give and give and give get to a point where they're giving kind of too much and they're forgetting their own needs, and they're not able to recognize perhaps even what their own needs are, let alone, you know, honor them. So that's the kind of the snapshot of the superhelper and the superhelper syndrome.
That's a bit of that ethos in positive psychology. So we always tell the students that there's no point in thinking about what you can do for another person or for a community if at first you feel you haven't got anything to give. You need to look at what we can do with positive emotions, how they operate, and how you can better things for yourself, how you can improve things to make sure first and foremost you feel okay before then you can actually start to extend these. Because then we talk about the very end of this, where ultimately you could end up with burnout syndrome and you've just completely given as much as you can give and you just feel completely exhausted as well. With my own research, I've looked at things like goal attainment and hope, but then the opposite, when people feel that they've entered a state of learned hopelessness as well, where they've tried everything and everything just seems to be a complete failure, so they feel they've literally reached zero and we need to kind of get them up again.
Cal, that's fascinating. Learned hopelessness, my goodness. Wondering if that's my new title, my autobiography.
Oh, no.
That's brilliant. Thank you. But Cal, but before we go to our next caller in, what are your thoughts about sleep worker dreams? You know, have you had in your PhD students, your parapsychology research, people who in the dream state are present at scenes of crisis or are helping others in the dream state? Have you had any stories about that sent in?
There's a few, and dream precognition, where it all started with the studies on dream precognition at Maimonides Medical Center in the 1960s with the medium Eileen Garrett and people like Stanley Krippner and Alan Bourne and Larry Lachan working on that with Whately Carrington. But I think one of the most fantastical ones, we've mentioned him before, you and I have spoken about him, Dr. Alex Tanis. So now and then he'd report bilocations, but he would be in one place asleep, New York City, at the American SPR, when in Canada, in one particular example, a friend awakes to a knock at the door, and it's Alex. At the same time, he's asleep in New York City, and they have a whole conversation. They sit down and drink a cup of tea. The wife hears them from the other room, and then he shows Alex to the door and waits just in case there's car trouble because it's snowing, and there's no sound. So he opens the door. There's no Alex. There's no car. And there's no footsteps in the snow to or away from the front door. Alex awakes and believes he's had this whole experience, so writes it down. The couple write their experience down and send them to Dr. Carlos Osif's for sworn affidavits on the whole thing. So it's weird to be having a dream, but then actually physically seen and experienced somewhere else. We call this bilocation. There's some fascinating examples throughout psychical research history of this.
Fascinating. So if you're listening maybe and you wake up tired and there's no medical reasons, perhaps your soul in your sleep has been very busy helping others indeed. Cal, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Listen next time.
I'm going from one thing to the other.
I know you've been, but I'm absolutely super delighted. You will recognize this wonderful lady I'm about to introduce now. And I know Jess will. I was trying to keep it a surprise that she'd be here. Because I know you admire her work greatly. A friend of this show and UK Health Radio, previous special guest, Dr. Julia Mossbridge is here. Hello, Julia. Do you want to introduce yourself again and ask Jess a question?
Hello. Dr. Julia Mossbridge, happy to surprise you all. Great to see you, Cal. And great to see you again, Jess. And I'm a cognitive neuroscientist who looks at exceptional human capacities. And I'm excited to be here, especially, Jess, with your book. I don't know how much you've had a chance to talk about the differences in class and how the SAVE equation speaks to who will help and who will not help, and where superhelper syndrome ends up getting registered, and generally people who have less money and fewer resources to share. But that's something that's on my mind. I don't know if you want to talk about that.
Well, I mean, I'd love you to talk about that. What's going on in your mind, Julia? That sounds fascinating.
Well, I'm going to jump in because Julia's humble to say she's just released an amazing book called Have a Nice Disclosure, which I know what's going on. If you want to know what's going on in Dr. Julia Mossbridge's mind, read that book. Anyway, Julia, back to you.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, no, that book is an attempt to sort of take people on a little wander through my mind. That's true. Thank you, Teresa, for mentioning it. I don't know if you want to talk about this, but it kept occurring to me when I knew I was going to see you, because there's this question of who has super helper syndrome and how class plays into it. Mm-hmm. And that save equation that you cite in your book. And I'm sorry, this is super nerdy, so let me just make it a little bit more accessible. There's this equation she puts in her book, and she doesn't make people figure it out, which is awesome. she just goes ahead, super helper syndrome. She just goes ahead and says, here's what I want you to notice about this equation. And what Jess, you want people to notice about the equation is that sometimes people help even when there's no benefit to themselves. And also you want people to notice that it really depends on whether they're feeling part of this group, but part of the group of the person who needs help. And because there's more people who have less money in the world these days, I just wonder if super helper syndrome is more common among people who have less money and less time and less resource, fewer resources to share as a result.
Oh, that's so fascinating, Julia. Thank you. Thank you for moving that on, that save equation that we use. You know, I think that's a really interesting line of inquiry. I want to say intuitively, but also based on evidence, that I think you're more likely to have a compulsion to give if you are if you're not a billionaire, you know, if you're not following a high profile, let's say, highly educated route necessarily. Perhaps if that should be the case, okay, perhaps because, as you say, empathy, and we know this, and Paul Bloom has written about this as well, empathy likes to zone in on people like you, you know, and we have a tendency to relate to people like us. And so there can easily be an essence of, well, I relate to that person or that group of people, therefore I want to help them more. And it may be because there are more people who aren't, you know, tech billionaires, let's say, for the sake of argument, then, you know, we're more likely to help one another. We see each other as equals or in the same group as such. I have a lot to say on moving into the kind of toxic empathy space, but that's a whole other conversation to be had, because I think if your empathy is toxic, it's actually not empathy. But I think that where we end up with who helps, I think you can probably almost always trace it back to childhood and to plus cultural standards, plus societal standards. So I have worked with a number of high profile people who are super helpers, who have a compulsion to help. You know, there are a number of people who are political leaders, not many, but there are, you know, they are in anything from engineering through to tech, and I've worked with some of them. And so it's really important to say that in every person's case, I think, is very personal and very individual. You can often tie it back to how you brought up, what rules were you brought up to live by? And some people were brought up to see very distinct communities as worse off. For example, a woman comes to mind who I interviewed, whose father was an alcoholic until she was born, and then they went off to serve alcoholics within the local community. So she wasn't an alcoholic, she didn't have that direct experience, but she had an indirect experience, and she was taught that helping that set of people. So it was like vicariously thinking about that community, because her father felt close to that community, she therefore went off to work in that field. It's fascinating, isn't it?
It is.
And do you have a super sense now with people when you meet them that they're going to be super helpers? I mean, of the lineup here, are you zoning in?
I try not to. I try not to make any rash or intuitive decision too soon, but I collate all that data, work through it quite quickly, and then make a decision. Yeah, so of course I get a hunch, a sense, an intuition about some people. The moment I get a, so I have a free coaching call before I sign up anybody's to make sure that we can work well together, that I'm perfect for them and they're perfect for me. And within minutes, like that's just 15 minutes long, but it doesn't take that long usually to for each of us to make a decision about whether this is going to work. So I think a lot of us have that capacity, don't we, to delve in, to attach or to connect with our intuition. And I think the work you do, Teresa, is amazing on that, you know.
I think dreams can shine a spotlight that on when you're giving a little bit too much of yourself, because dreams love to put a red flag areas of your life where there's an imbalance. And oh my goodness, I just want to treasure this moment. I've got this amazing roll call of people together. I can't thank you enough for being here. A huge thank you, Jess, for your wisdom, and to Frida, Cal, and Julia for all that you do, and to all the caring, dreaming listeners out there who give so much of their heart to the world. And if you are dreaming of your teeth falling out or you're missing a train, I hope you will see it as a wake-up call, not as negative. Your dreaming mind is simply nudging you to slow down, trust your timing, and put yourself first a little more and back on your own life path. And I'm going to close today's show with a song dedicated to Jess and all the carers out there, every empath and intuitive. And to help them receive as much as they give, it's a very famous track. It's Fix You by Coldplay. And it's a beautiful reminder that healing begins with compassion, not just for others, but also for yourself. Yes, it can seem like a sad song, but did you know, everyone listening, that there's research now to show that listening to sad songs can actually have the opposite effect and boost your mood? And it's the same with sad dreams and nightmares. They are very, very cathartic and healing. Until next week, keep on dreaming, keep healing, and keep listening to the sounds of wisdom within you. They're trying to fix you.
When you try your best, but you don't succeed. When you get what you want, but not what you need. When you feel so tired but you can't sleep, stuck in reverse, and the tears come streaming down your face. When you lose something you can't replace. When you love someone it goes to waste. Could it be worse? Lights will guide you home and ignite your bones, and I but if you never try.